Okay, great. Welcome, everyone. I believe, according to the email that Rabbi Robinson sent out, that this past Shabbos was the first Shabbos where the shul had been either completely open or almost completely open. It's an incredible milestone, and God willing, we will continue to advance further and further, and God willing, it'll only be a matter of time before we're back to pre-pandemic levels. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to be with you this past week, but God willing, I am looking forward to joining you all back again soon. I was there for Shavuos; it was an incredible experience, and I'm very much excited to be back again very soon. Okay. Once again, as we say every week, the learning of the Mishnah and the Rambam's introduction to the Mishnah is in memory of those that were killed in the Meron tragedy, as well as those that were killed during the past operation in Israel, as well as for the continued refuah shalema for those to be completely healed throughout the world, throughout the Jewish people, and especially for Lloyd Epstein. Okay. This week is probably the most important class in this series. The last 2 weeks, we have been learning about the Rambam's conception of nevuah, of prophecy, which is extremely important for Judaism. The Rambam says that it is one of the fundamental tenets of faith that God communicates with humanity. But as far as the Rambam's work that we're studying now, the introduction to Mishnah, which is essentially an introduction to Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law, this is probably the most important or central class that we're going to have in the series. It's where the Rambam describes the different parts of Torah Sheba'al Peh, of the oral law, and the Rambam addresses a very critical question, which many of those who challenged the authenticity of Torah Sheba'al Peh, of the oral law, levied against rabbinic Judaism, which is the nature of debate. The fact that there exists a multitude of arguments in Torah Sheba'al Peh, in the Mishnah, in the Gemara, it's filled with disagreements. And if that's the case, it doesn't seem to really buttress the credibility of the Torah Sheba'al Peh. If we believe that there was a tradition that God communicated things not in the written Torah, in addition to that, in addition to the Bible, to the Tanakh, we also got these additional oral laws or oral commentaries to the written Torah, then why is there debate? Why is there machloket? Why are we arguing and debating about what ostensibly God told humanity? It must be that we either messed it up, we misunderstood, or we're making it up, God forbid. And so what the Rambam does here is outline exactly what was given at Sinai, what was developed later, and what is subject to debate. The nice thing about this is that the Rambam itemizes it. The Rambam is one of the greatest organizers in Jewish literature. And he did a really nice job here into breaking down the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law, into five parts. So before we even get into the actual Rambam's text, I'm just going to show you outside. I made a chart, which I think, or I made an outline, which I think would be very helpful. So what was given at Sinai? So the numbers or the titles that I highlighted in yellow are biblical things. As we know, in Judaism, there are biblical laws and there are rabbinic laws, laws that God gave us, laws that are in the Torah, as well as laws that the rabbis legislated later on. So the yellow ones are biblical laws. So the first category, which the Rambam will talk about, is the Pirush Mekubal Misinai, which translated into English is interpretations of biblical verses that were given at Sinai. So we all believe, and the Rambam lists this as one of the fundamental tenets of Jewish faith, one of the 13 principles of Jewish faith, the Yud Gimel Ikrim, that God gave the written Torah to Moshe at Sinai, or God communicated the mitzvos or the text of the Torah to Moshe at Sinai, and Moshe wrote it down either then or a little bit later throughout the 40 years in the desert. Whatever it is, God communicated the Torah, the written Torah. In addition to the written Torah, there was a commentary, an oral commentary to explain ambiguous verses. So, for example, one of the classical examples is ayin tachas ayin, an eye for an eye. If you would read that literally, that would mean that if you gouge someone's eye out, the punishment would be that your eye would be gouged out. If you cut someone's hand off, then we cut your hand off. So the Pirush Mekubal Misinai, the interpretation of that verse that was given at Sinai, is that it is not meant to be taken literally. Rather, it is supposed to be financial compensation. God decided to write it in a very ambiguous way, or a very poor way of writing it, if it seems to give us the opposite impression. That's a discussion for another time. But regardless, that is an example of a Pirush Mekubal Misinai, another example of an interpretation that was given at Sinai, an esrog. The Torah doesn't say take an esrog on Sukkos. The Torah says take a pre-Eitz Hadar, which if we would translate that, what that means is the fruit of a tree that is beautiful. So beauty is subjective. I could find one of the examples that the Torah gives is a peppercorn. Maybe I think that a peppercorn is beautiful. It's symmetrical, it's black, there's a lot of little ones on a single branch. Why don't I take a peppercorn on Sukkos? So the Torah just says a beautiful fruit. Nevertheless, in addition to the biblical text, God gave us a pirush, an interpretation, a commentary to say that, by the way, what is considered beautiful, it's an esrog. It's a beautiful fruit is an esrog. So there are many of these examples, but not a huge amount in rabbinic literature. Those are probably the most famous ones. There are some other ones as well. The Rambam in the actual text that we'll see, he'll give a couple more examples. The Rambam says that this category is something that there was never any debate about. The Gemara tries to figure out how we understand from the text that pre-Eitz Hadar is referring to an esrog, but there was never actually any doubt about it or any debate or any argument about it. Moreover, the Rambam says, if a trustworthy person comes to us and says, I know all of you, all of the rabbis in that generation are explaining the verse one way, but I'm telling you that I have a tradition going back all the way to Moshe Rabbeinu that God told Moshe that actually this verse means something else, assuming that this person is a believable person, is a Torah scholar, is a righteous person, we accept it without question. We accept their tradition without question, and all of the arguments, however logical they may be, that run against this commentary, if the person says this is a commentary that we received from God at Sinai, we believe them. And this is something that Rev Shilat points out, Rev Yitzchak Shilat, who wrote a commentary to the Rambam's introduction to Mishnah. If you look at the examples throughout the Talmud, and throughout the Mishnah, and throughout the Medrash of Pirush Mekubal Misinai, of examples where interpretations of verses were given to us from Sinai, those are all things that are critical to the mitzvah, that without knowing these interpretations, we would either not know how to do the mitzvah or get the mitzvah completely wrong. So going back to our example, if we didn't know what a pre-Eitz Hadar was, we could never fulfill the mitzvah of taking the four species on Sukkos. We would be shaking something else. We just wouldn't know how to do the mitzvah. Or an eye for an eye. We would be hurting people, maiming people for no reason. We wouldn't know how to fulfill the mitzvah of judging people and executing justice with financial compensation instead of physical punishment. So anything that is a Pirush Mekubal Misinai, anything that is an interpretation of a biblical verse, is a critical core aspect of the mitzvah. In contrast, is what is more commonly known, and the Rambam says people conflated these two concepts. The second one is what is called a halacha lemoshe misinai, a law given to Moshe at Sinai that has absolutely no source in the Torah. Unlike the previous category where there is a verse in the Torah and it's just we need to know how to understand it, there were also a very small group of halachos, as we'll see, the Rambam counts 33 of them, that were given to Moshe at Har Sinai that have absolutely no source in the Torah itself. The Rambam says that people used to conflate these two categories, but in actuality, the Rambam says they're very different. The second category has absolutely no basis in the written Torah itself. Nevertheless, because we believe and we have a tradition that God communicated these mitzvos and these laws to Moshe at Har Sinai, there is never any debate. There was never any doubt about these halachos. There was never any argument about them. Now, what's interesting is that Rav Shilat points out in a footnote to his commentary that if you actually look in the Gemara, there actually was a little bit of debate about them or a little bit of doubt about them. The Rambam seems to have glossed over this because we have to consider the audience of who he was writing for. The Rambam, as we discussed in previous classes, was writing for people that were just beginning to study Torah, that were just beginning to study the written Torah, the oral Torah, and were also just beginning to be exposed to genuine rabbinic Jewish theology as opposed to Karaite theology. So the Rambam really glossed over the more nuanced aspects of his argument. When I was taking general chemistry in college, there were things about the atomic model that we studied about how the electrons orbited the nucleus of an atom, how different ions were formed, how different electrons the term is an excited state, when they were given an extra infusion of energy, they would jump to higher energy levels. Our professor told us explicitly that what he's telling us is not 100% true, that the argument is much more nuanced, but because we haven't been exposed to more complicated, more advanced levels of chemistry, of physics, of mathematics, this was sort of the baseline, which was true on a certain level. And then as we grew and advanced in our knowledge, we would actually gain a more nuanced perspective. So that's what Rav Shilat is saying, that the Rambam did something similar. There may have actually been historically some debates, some arguments, but by and large, and the general ethos of a halach lemoshe misinai is that there were never any debates and there can never be any debates. And anything that arises were aberrations in Jewish history where people were especially forgetful or especially unequipped to handle that. But by and large, and ideally, and generally, there was never any debate about these things. A difference, though, another difference between a halacha lemoshe misinai and a pirush mekubal misinai was that a pirush mekubal misinai, we said, always hones in on the core aspect of a mitzvah. That if we didn't know how to interpret a verse, we wouldn't be able to fulfill the mitzvah properly. Halacha lemoshe misinais, laws that have no basis in the Torah, they might be a core aspect, but on the other hand, they might be a very, very, very minute detail in a larger halachic framework. So I'll give you some examples. The Rambam lists 33, as I said. We're not going to read a list of them. I'll just give you a couple of examples. One is that tefillin are supposed to be black. The straps are supposed to be black. The casings for the parchment are supposed to be black. Torah never says it. And there's no verse in the Torah that you can interpret to allude to that fact. We just know it because God told us that at Har Sinai. Another example are shiurim, measurements. The Torah never says how you measure things. So for example, there are many mitzvos in the Torah of things that we're supposed to eat. We're supposed to eat matzah on Pesach. We're supposed to eat marah on Pesach. We're supposed to eat sacrifices. Kohanim, priests, are supposed to eat truma. Leviim, Levites, are supposed to eat maaser. There are many examples of commandments that involve eating. How much are you supposed to eat? So the Torah never says. And there are no verses in the Torah that can be interpreted to show you that. Interestingly, the Gemara in Brachos, I believe, does try to find allusions or hints to it. And the Rambam acknowledges this in his commentary that we'll see if we have time. But the Rambam says that those are what are called asmachtos, hints or allusions to kind of support the tradition. But in actuality, you can't really derive it from there. Another example of a shiur, of a measurement. Carrying on Shabbos. So one of the 39 activities that are forbidden on Shabbos are carrying. You're not allowed to carry without an Eruv. Nevertheless, the biblical prohibition only refers to a specific amount of carrying. Rabbinically, any carrying is forbidden, but biblically, and in the days of the Beis HaMikdash, you would need to bring a carbon, a sacrifice, if you accidentally carried. Excuse me. So what is the shear? What is the measurement? That's another halacha l'moshe mi'sinai. A third one, arla. There's a prohibition called arla, which is that the first 3 years that a tree bears fruit, you're not allowed to eat it. You have to burn it. Now, most agricultural laws only pertain in the land of Israel. And in fact, when the Torah discusses the laws of Arla, it frames it as applying in the land of Israel. So I would think that if I would plant an apple tree in the United States, I could eat the first year's crop of produce. Now, they're not usually very good. The Medrash says that the first 3 years are generally the worst ones, and that highlights God's kindness to us, that if we have to give something to God, we don't have to give the best of the best. God wants us to enjoy that. But regardless, I would think that I could eat the first year's crop. Nevertheless, there is a halacha l'Moshe Misinai. There is an oral tradition that we have that God gave to Moshe at Har Sinai that has absolutely no source in the written Torah, that it applies even outside the land of Israel. And so if there are any Jewish farmers, they have to wait 4 years for some things. They actually have to wait 3 to 4 years before being able to partake in certain fruits. So as you see in these examples, some of them are more central to mitzvos than other ones, but some of them are very small details. What would be an interesting project, and I haven't seen anybody discusses it, and if any of you are interested, you can take a look at the Rambam's list and try to find out why specifically these 33 things God decided to not write in the Torah and decided to transmit to us orally. I don't know. I'm curious if there is a common theme. There might not be. But if anybody comes up or sees anything, I urge you to let me know. I'd be very interested in finding out. The third category. And this is probably the category we are most familiar with and the one that is the most recurring in rabbinic literature, especially in the Gemara, are derashos, laws that are derived using the 13 hermeneutical principles that were given at Sinai. We mentioned in previous classes that the Rambam wrote that God did not give all of the laws at Har Sinai. God did not give all of the halachos, all of the laws that we have today. What did God give us? God gave us, according to what we just saw, God gave us the written Torah. He gave us interpretations to those verses, select interpretations, Pirush Mekubal Misinai, certain interpretations to biblical verses. And those, we said, are core, central to the mitzvahs, that without them we just wouldn't know what to do. The third category are halacha l'moshe mi'sinai, things that have no source in the Torah. So obviously God needed to give us that orally. The fourth thing that he gave us, and the third thing of Torah sheba'al peh, are drashos, laws that are derived using the 13 hermeneutical principles. God didn't give us the laws, rather he gave us the tools to interpret the verses on our own. God gave us rules. Most famously, there are 13 of them. Some people have a tradition of having more, and 13 are just really general categories for tools of interpretation. But regardless, God gave us divinely sanctioned tools to analyze the biblical text. And God didn't tell us which interpretations were right. And in fact, the Rambam says, these laws were developed over history by sages in every generation. And unlike the Pirush Mekubal Misinai, which were interpretations that were central, these were details. The Rambam earlier in the text that we saw the first week that we began called them anafim, branches. They weren't the roots. They weren't the trunk. They weren't the core essence of the mitzvah. They were details of mitzvahs. They were details of mitzvahs that evolved over history, that over time, there were many different questions that came up. Everybody had different cases. The first time around when people kept Pesach, they may have had certain questions. Then the second year around, they may have had different questions. And then the third year around, they may have a different set of questions. Just to bring it into a slightly more contemporary context, Pesach last year, during the height of Corona, gave birth to many, many unique questions. We had to do our best to try to find the answers using the tools that we have. Now, we don't interpret verses nowadays to arrive at the halacha, and at the end of this series, we'll know why. But back then, the sages would do the best they could by looking at the verses and trying to interpret them to answer their questions. Now, this category, the Rambam says, was subject to debate. People would basically argue whose interpretation was the most logical using these tools, using these divinely mandated principles, these divine corollaries. God said to humanity, I want you to do your best using these tools to figure out what the text says. And people hashed it out. Every generation, people were debating back and forth what they thought the correct interpretation was. And in each generation, obviously, there needed to be a certain consensus. And the consensus, the Rambam says, was decided by majority. So in each generation, you would interpret it. People would duke it out. The rabbis would argue back and forth, and they would arrive at what they believed was the correct interpretation. Now, the Rambam doesn't say this explicitly here, but as we'll see, he does say it in other places. The Rambam does say in other places that this category was subject to judicial review. What that means is that in a subsequent generation, if a group of rabbis were so confident, and again, you needed to have a lot of guts and self-assurance to do this, but if you felt that a previous generation had interpreted a verse incorrectly, not a Pirush Mekubal Misinai, not something that we have a tradition that God told us to interpret a verse, and certainly not a law that has no source in the Torah, but was rather a halacha l'Moshe Misinai that God just gave directly, but something that was humanly derived from the Torah, if you felt that an earlier generation got it wrong, the current generation could overturn it if there was a consensus of the majority. And this category, the Rambam says, is where most debates in the Talmud fall into. Most of the debate in the Talmud with regard to interpreting verses are not things that God gave us at Sinai. There can't be debates about that. Rather, God gave us tools and left it in humanity's hands to interpret the Torah, and God expected us to duke it out. And so that, the Rambam says, is why we have debates in the Talmud. The majority of debates will fall into either this category or merely a matter of policy, as we'll see later on. But most of the debates that revolve around biblical verses fall into this category, and that's why we have so many arguments. And that's why arguments do not present a threat to the integrity of the Mesorah, of the tradition, because our tradition itself is that there should be debate and that Torah should continue to evolve and develop based on interpreting the text using the tools that God gave us. Now, again, before we move on, I just want to reiterate that we don't do this nowadays anymore. And there's a question as to why. So the short answer is because we don't feel confident enough. The Rambam doesn't say this here. It was a big question that came about during the early reform movement as to why we don't do it nowadays. And a lot of rabbis over the centuries have struggled with this. during the last class, when the Rambam comes back to that theme, hopefully we'll learn that more at length and in depth. But those are the three biblical categories of laws that are part of Torah Sheba'al Peh, of the oral law. Now, the Rambam says that there are two other categories of laws which are rabbinic in nature. The first are what are called gezeros, which are literally translated as decrees. They are laws that the rabbis legislated to facilitate adherence to biblical law. What that means is that, as we spoke about in the last 2 weeks, prophets and rabbis cannot make new mitzvos. They can't say that there are, instead of 613 mitzvos, there are 614 mitzvos. You can't do that. The only time rabbinic innovation in halacha that has nothing to do with verses in the Torah, whether it be by a court or by a prophet, has to fall into these next two categories. The first are gezeros, which were laws that the rabbis enacted to facilitate people keeping the mitzvos better. So one of the most, I guess, prevalent examples of that we have are not eating chicken and meat. The Torah says that you're not allowed to eat milk and meat together. You're not allowed to do that. The Torah actually, though, if you read the verse literally, it actually says you cannot cook milk and meat together, and we interpret from the verses that you're not allowed to eat milk and meat that were cooked together as well. It does not say that you can have raw or milk and meat that were not cooked together. So theoretically, if I had a cold hamburger and I had cold American cheese, biblically, I could eat a cheeseburger. Rabbinically, the rabbi said, no, you cannot do that. Another example related to milk and meat, chicken and meat. The Torah said, you cannot have milk and meat cooked together. The Torah never said you can't have chicken. Chicken is not meat. Chicken is poultry. So theoretically, I could have chicken with a cheese sauce and pasta together. Nevertheless, the rabbi said, listen, delineating between chicken and meat, or meat and milk that are not cooked together, people will either not be careful enough, they'll forget, they'll get confused, it looks too similar, people won't be able to logistically run a kitchen that way, it'll be too complicated, and people are going to end up messing up. They're going to end up making mistakes. And therefore, the rabbi said that this is not a new mitzvah. This is not a 614th mitzvah. Rather, this is a safeguard that we are enacting to prevent you from slipping up with the biblical prohibition of eating milk and meat that were cooked together. Another classic example is muktzah. This is actually has an allusion to it in the book of Nehemiah, in one of the last books in Tanakh that was ever written, but it was very clearly a rabbinic innovation. The Torah never says you can't hold or you can't carry something inside your house. Obviously, the Torah says you're not allowed to carry outside of your house in a public domain, but inside your house, the Torah never says that you can't pick up a hammer or you can't pick up a candle. Torah never says that. It's not one of the 39 things that are prohibited. The Torah never says you can't carry something that you do malacha, that you do work with. The rabbis, however, going back many, many generations from the very beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash, they saw that people couldn't do it. If you would carry around a candle, you're going to end up lighting something with it. You're going to end up lighting the candle. If you walk around with a hammer, you're going to end up building something with it. That's one example. Another reason for muktzah was that if you walk around with a hammer, it's not really you're detracting from the atmosphere of Shabbos. You're not taking Shabbos as seriously as you used to, and that will lead to actual desecration of Shabbos, which historically, both in ancient times when these decrees were initially enacted, as well as to this very day when unfortunately many Jews do not keep Shabbos, that is the slippery slope. And so the rabbi said that there's no biblical prohibition. There's no 614th mitzvah for carrying these things. But nevertheless, we are saying that you cannot carry them. What is the source that the rabbis are allowed to do this? So the Rambam says that it's a pasuk in Vayikra. It's a verse in Leviticus that says, Ushamartem es mishmarti, you shall keep my charge. That's literally what it translates into. And the Gemara understands that to mean that you're supposed to guard God's mitzvos. How do you guard God's mitzvos? You guard it by setting up a safeguard, by putting a fence around it, by putting in extra hurdles, extra prohibitions to prevent you from slipping up on the main one. That's what authorizes the rabbis to create these additional safeguards. And why are the rest of the Jews obligated to follow them? The Torah says in Devarim, Al pi ha-Torah asher yorucha v'al ha-mishpat asher yomru lach ta'aseh, you shall act in accordance with the instructions given to you and the ruling handed down to you. Lo sasur min ha-davar asher yagidu lecha yumin usmal. Do not turn from what they, from any small thing that they tell you to do, left or right. Now, that seems to be almost in addition to what the rabbis are telling you. So the Gemara understands this to mean that you're, even when the rabbis tell you to either do or not do something that's not in the Torah, that it's something additional. And they're not saying that the actual Torah has more mitzvot, but they're appending something onto it, then you are obligated to listen to them. A similar but not identical category is the last category, are takanot. Laws that the rabbis legislated, and again, these are my translations, so you might find one that's a little bit different and perhaps it's a little bit more accurate. But the way I understand this last category, it's the most ambiguous, but it's arguably one of the most important ones, which is laws that the rabbis legislated that are not associated with particular biblical commandments, but were deemed necessary for the nation to grow as a people, to help their relationship with God or to help their relationship with each other. The most classical example is Hanukkah and Purim. Hanukkah and Purim have no source in the Torah. Some people have argued, the Ramban may have argued that it does, but the vast majority, I would say 99% of both medieval and subsequent rabbinic authorities have said that Hanukkah and Purim have absolutely no basis in the Torah. There's nothing that says in the Torah that if somebody tries to wipe out all the Jews and a miracle happens and you get saved, that you're supposed to create a holiday, that you're supposed to read Megillah, that you're supposed to light a menorah. The Torah never says that. There might be a precedent to say that when the entire nation is saved, you're supposed to praise God. But to legislate the mitzvah of reading Megillah or lighting the menorah, there's absolutely no basis for that in the Torah. And so you can't even say that the rabbis were doing this to safeguard a particular mitzvah because there was no mitzvah. Nevertheless, the Rambam says that if the rabbis believe that legislating something is better or a good policy to improve the Jewish people's relationship with God or themselves, the sages have the ability to do that. Another example, which will be relevant, according to many people, this coming year, in the next few months, is Prusbul. Prusbul is a document or a legal mechanic that is designed to collect debts after Shemitah. So just as a bit of background, once every 7 years in Israel, God said that after every 7 years, after 6 years, the seventh year in a cycle, you need to rest from working the land. You're not allowed to pursue agriculture work, which is what the vast majority of Jews were occupied professionally doing during the time of the Beis HaMikdash or when they lived in Israel. Instead, they were supposed to devote their time to learning, improving their relationship with God, improving their relationship with each other. It was supposed to be a time of rest. Now, in addition to the land resting, there's also another resting that took place then, which is what's called Shmitas Ksafim or Hashmatas Ksafim, which means that money would rest as well. What that meant is that all outstanding debts, with perhaps one or two exceptions, would be erased. So if I owed someone $1 million and Shemitah would come in the middle of that time, then I wouldn't owe the person anything. And so naturally, all loans were structured for like 6 years, that you needed to pay them back within 6 years, or you needed to realistically be able to pay them back in 6 years, and they would lend you amount of money based on how close it was to Shemitah. So let's say somebody needed a ton of money, but it was only a year away from Shemitah. So people would be very, very reticent to lend the money because they said, you won't be able to pay it all back in 1 year. And in 1 year, you won't actually owe me any money. And so during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash and afterwards, people really stopped lending each other money because they were afraid that they wouldn't get paid back. And so one of the rabbis, Hillel, saw this and said, we need to create a mitzvah, we need to create a new legal mechanic that will preserve this. And they basically created something which is very similar to what we do for mechiras chametz. You're not allowed to own chametz, so we create this legal fiction of selling our chametz to a non-Jew over Pesach. Again, I'm not going into all the details. There's a lot of complicated nuance into how legally this works. But basically, you sell your debt to a Beis Din, to a Jewish court, which is authorized to be able to collect debts even after Shemitah has passed. Basically, Hillel created a legal fiction. Hillel effectively changed halacha. How he did it, again, is a little bit too complicated to talk about now. You could have many shiurim on how he was able to do that. But basically, Hillel enacted, created something new to be able to navigate an issue that he felt was critical for the Jewish people's relationship to God in terms of keeping the mitzvot, as well as their relationship with other people, with other Jews. And for the same reason of gezeros, the Jewish people are obligated to follow them. Lo sasur min hadavar asher yagidu lecha yamin u'smol. You cannot turn away from what they tell you to do, whether it be left or right. And what's interesting is that the Gemara darshans, it interprets those words, left and right, to say even if they tell you that left is right and right is left, meaning even if they tell you to do something or to not do something that appears to be contrary to halacha, you are obligated to follow them. This prusbel, this legal mechanic, seems to be diametrically opposed to what God told you to do. Nevertheless, because the sages created this mechanic, they created this takana, we are obligated to follow it. And what's also interesting is that unlike the drashos, unlike the biblical interpretations that, not that God gave us, but that humanity derived using the principles that God gave us that I said were subject to judicial review, that if a subsequent generation felt confident enough that they were right and a previous generation was wrong, they could overturn an interpretation. These two categories, gezeros, laws that the rabbis legislated to facilitate adherence to biblical law, and takanos, laws that the rabbis legislated not associated with biblical commandments, but they felt were nevertheless necessary for the nation as a public policy standpoint for their relationship with God or their relationship with themselves. There is no concept of judicial review. One generation cannot overturn an earlier generation's decisions in these regards, with two exceptions. One is if the current generation and their sages are greater in wisdom and number. The way Rav Shilat explains it, and I think it's very beautiful, is that these two categories are policies. They're not mitzvos. The Rambam says you can't add mitzvos. The way the Rambam conceptualized these two categories, these two rabbinic categories, is that these were policies. If you remember, we spoke about last week about how a prophet was empowered to tell people to do things that were in contradistinction to halacha if they believed that this was the appropriate thing to do at that time. It would benefit either this particular person or it would benefit the Jewish people. And I also mentioned last week that the Navi, the prophet, was not alone in that regard, but rather Beis Din, or the national governing authority on Jewish law, was also empowered to do that. The Navi was unique. The prophet was unique in that he was able to do it on his own. And what's interesting is that the Rambam will actually mention in the text a prophet and his court many times. So the Rambam really conceptualized a prophet with regards to manipulating halacha, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean just in terms of either changing or temporarily changing or adding, as basically a mini court. And so an actual court, an actual Beis Din, were able to legislate laws. And the only way you can overturn a policy is if your policy governing body was even greater. When it comes to interpreting a biblical text, there, what you're trying to do is not use your own particular mind to create halacha. You're not trying to create halacha. You're using your mind to understand what God wants. So therefore, the Rambam believes that if you're trying to understand what God wants, if you believe that you genuinely know what God wants, then there can be many more people in a previous generation that may have been smarter or may have been more numerous than your current group. But if you believe that they misunderstood God, then this current governing body, this current Jewish court, has the authority to overturn it. But these two categories are not interpreting biblical verses. They're not trying to figure out what God wants. They're trying to say what they believe the Jewish people need to do. And so therefore, the only way you can overturn a policy decision is if your policy body is greater than their policy governing body. So these two categories, gezeros and takanos, can only be overturned by a future court if that future court is greater in wisdom and numbers. So if for some reason nowadays we wanted to get rid of Hanukkah or we wanted to get rid of Purim because we didn't want people to, I don't know, eat Hamantashen or Sufganiyot or something like that, we could not do that unless our group of sages throughout the entire Jewish world that agreed together, which, as we probably are familiar with, unfortunately doesn't happen all that often anyway, even a consensus of rabbis in this time could not overturn such a mitzvah or such a decision. Like, let's say we wanted to get rid of muktzah. We could not do that unless our sum total body of rabbis was greater in wisdom and numbers than the rabbis who enacted it earlier, which historically has often been an impossibility. The rabbis who legislated muktzah were the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. They were the people, 120 great rabbis and prophets. We could never match that. We have never matched that, or we have probably almost never matched that. And similarly with Hanukkah and Purim. The Anshei Knesset HaGdola were around when Purim was made. Hanukkah was obviously later than that, but there were many, many great rabbis there that we just don't feel confident enough to say that we're better than them. That's one, that's sort of one way which we could potentially overturn it. Again, practically, I said we can't, or we almost never do. There is, however, one other way to overturn one of these categories. Takanos cannot be overturned unless the current court is greater in wisdom and number. Gezeros, however, laws that the rabbi has legislated to facilitate adherence to biblical law, basically laws that were enacted to prevent you from doing something else, there was another way to overturn it. And that is, if the rabbis who enacted that gezeirah gave an explicit reason why not, why they're making this, if that reason no longer applies, then it's not that we're overturning it, it's just that the initial enactment goes away. It dissipates. It's irrelevant. Most laws, however, were not given in such a structure. So for example, milk and meat, the prohibition of eating milk and meat that are not cooked together, or chicken and meat, those laws, even though ostensibly it was to prevent people from mixing it up, the Chachamim never said that explicitly. They never said that we're only enacting this for a time period where people would mix it up. And so honestly, people mix it up. People could mix it up nowadays too, but I don't know. Let's say that there was the way that the America worked was that everybody had completely separate kitchens for milk and meat, and chicken looked totally different than meat. So I could potentially rationalize having chicken with milk because never the twain shall meet. Nevertheless, because the rabbis didn't explicitly say this caveat that it could be undone, when the reason was no longer relevant, even if the reason is no longer relevant, the initial enactment still stays. And that's why most gezeros, like mukta, will never go away again unless there is a group of sages that are greater in wisdom and number than the ones that enacted it. There is a third category, which is not a way to overturn it, but is a way in which the gezeira or takana does not go into effect. And that is that the Gemara talks about foods that are forbidden to eat that are not necessarily not kosher. So for example, Pas Yisrael, there's a term called Pas Yisrael, literally means Jewish bread. Pas Yisrael means that it is forbidden to eat bread that is baked by a non-Jewish baker. It was designed to prevent intermarriage. If people ate together, if people ate bread that was baked by a non-Jewish person, you would come to socialize together and it would lead to intermarriage. Now, we buy bread, or many of us do buy bread that is not baked by a Jewish person. We buy secular bread. The reason why is that the rabbi said that it's only artisan bread. So commercially baked bread, which is called pas palter in the Gemara's language, commercially baked bread is completely fine. It was never forbidden. And the reason is because the rabbis didn't believe that that would pose a threat to intermarriage. It's only when it's a very intimate environment where the baker bakes it and makes it look unique and different, that's when assimilation posed a threat. And so nowadays, whenever it is a artisan bread or it's a specially baked bread, even if all of the ingredients are kosher, nevertheless, you are not allowed to eat it. So that's why most secularly baked bread are commercial. There was another thing that the rabbis prohibited, which was shemen akum, which was oil that was produced by a non-Jewish person. Now, many of you, or I assume all of you, are probably saying, we don't do that. I've never heard of that before. And there's a good reason for that, is because that gezeira went away. That gezeira no longer applies. And in fact, it never actually took force. The reason is because the Gemara tells us that whenever the rabbis would make a gezeira, whenever the rabbis would institute a decree, again, not interpreting a verse, but coming up with something new that they believed was important and necessary, there would be an assessment period. The Gemara uses the language of a year. Whether that was meant to be literal or not, I don't know. It could be that it just means a necessary amount of time to assess. If people were able to do this, if people decided to listen to this or not, this was a policy decision. And so if the people didn't accept the policy, even if the Torah tells us that we should, if people decided that, listen, I can't do this, then the gzeira never took effect. And so people were able to handle the prohibition of bread that was baked by a non-Jew, but for various socioeconomic reasons, they couldn't handle the shemen akum part. They couldn't handle the oil that was produced by non-Jews. They just couldn't live without that. And so the gezeira, the law that the rabbis enacted, never took force because it was never accepted by the Jewish people. So a caveat to gezeira, both gezeiros and takanos, is that at the time they are initially decreed or legislated, they need to be accepted by the majority of the Jewish people. Once it's accepted, it is legally binding on all future generations in perpetuity. But if at the time it was enacted, people just couldn't do it, then the gzeros disappeared, the takanos disappeared, and they never took effect. And again, if you conceptualize these things as policies, then it makes a lot of sense. When it comes to interpreting biblical verses, you obviously have to listen to what the rabbis tell you to do because they're interpreting the Torah. It's not their authority, it's God's authority. They were just the ones that were empowered to interpret it. These things, these two categories, gezeros and takanos, these are not coming from God. They're coming from human beings. They're coming from humans that are leaders of the people. And so if the people decide that, listen, this is just a bad idea, this is a policy that's a bad idea, then even though they were supposed to listen to these rabbis, the Torah tells us that we're supposed to listen, if for whatever reason the community did not accept it, then it's not a policy. It's just somebody waving a sign in the air. And they're powerless. And as we'll see, this concept, which in Hebrew is known as Kabbalas Harabim, the acceptance of the masses, will have a very important halachic ramification much later on, in conjunction to what I discussed earlier, which is why we don't interpret biblical verses in the future. And that's a discussion for another time. We'll talk about it at the end of the series. But this concept of Kabbalas Harabim is an important caveat to these two categories. Even though we can't overturn a previously enacted gezeira or takana, the Jewish people can prevent them from going into effect. So I'm looking at the clock now. Unfortunately, it's getting very, very close to 10 o'clock. I don't think we will be able to actually read the text inside this week. I'm glad that we were able to go through the outline. I'm going to review it, and then we'll go through one last part, which is not these five categories, but a related topic, which the Rambam also talks about in this section. So let's just quickly go through these five categories of oral Torah. Again, we believe that God gave a written Torah to Moshe. In addition to that, God gave five parts of oral Torah to Moshe at Har Sinai, or gave us the tools to create them later on. The first is what's called Pirush Mekubal Misinai, interpretations of verses, of biblical verses that were given at Sinai to Moshe that explain core aspects of the mitzvah without which we wouldn't know what to do. The Rambam says there can be never any debate about this. There can never be any doubt about it. And if someone says they have a tradition, even if their tradition goes against all logic or rationality or number of people that are arguing against him, if this person is a trustworthy person that has smicha, not like the rabbinic ordination we have now, but basically a tradition and authorization of being a bearer of the tradition going back to Moshe, we have to accept it. Classic example, an eye for an eye is not meant to be taken literally. The second category, a halacha l'Moshe miSinai, laws that were given to Moshe at Sinai that have no source in the Torah. The Rambam says, once again, there was never any debate. Now, unlike the previous category, these could be either core aspects or very small details. And once again, we believe an individual, if they have a halacha l'Moshe miSinai, if they are a bearer of the tradition, we have to accept it, even if it goes against biblical verses or rationality. The Rambam says this is a very small category of mitzvahs. He counts 33. One example, probably one of the more famous ones, tefillin are supposed to be black. The third category, this is probably the most ubiquitous in the Gemara, which are drashos, laws that were derived by human beings interpreting the text of the Torah using principles that God gave us. These are laws that are details. The Rambam calls them branches. These are small details of mitzvos that God did not tell us at Har Sinai, but rather God wanted us to derive on our own as history and time progressed. These are naturally subject to debate and were decided in each generation by a majority consensus. The Rambam doesn't say this here, but the Rambam says in other places that they could be overturned by a subsequent generation if we believed confidently enough that the previous generation was wrong in understanding what God wanted. The Rambam says that most debates in the Talmud revolve around this category, and therefore, the fact that we have debates do not pose a threat to the integrity or the authenticity of the oral tradition, because God gave us the tools, but not the actual interpretations to these verses. Those are the biblical components of Torah Sheba'al Peh. There are two other rabbinic components to oral law. One are gezeros, which are laws that the rabbis legislated to facilitate adherence to biblical law. They were authorized to do this by the Torah, which says to guard my mitzvos, and we are obligated to listen to the sages. And so assuming that the entire Jewish people accepted upon themselves at one point in history to listen to what the sages said, it can never be overturned as a policy unless the subsequent generation is greater with rabbis in knowledge and number. The final category, and one example, is muktzah, or eating chicken and milk. The final category are takanos, which are laws that the rabbis legislated that have nothing to do with biblical commandments, like lighting the menorah or reading the Megillah or prusbo, the document that allows you to collect debts after Shemitah. So these have nothing to do with mitzvos, but rather they were general policy decisions that the sages believed were necessary for enhancing the Jewish people's connection with God or themselves, amongst themselves. And once again, if it is accepted, it cannot be overturned unless the future court is greater in wisdom and number. Okay, so with the few minutes that we have left, I want to talk about one other small implication from what we spoke about, which the Rambam also talks about, which is that if, ideally, there aren't supposed to be debates, meaning even in categories, even in the category where debates were intended, we were supposed to reach a consensus, right? We can debate about how to interpret verses using the 13 hermeneutical principles, trying to convince each other what is the most logical. But once we decide, why does it matter to record the minority opinions? Why do we record debates? Why do we preserve the history of the debate if we only care about what we're supposed to do? And so the Rambam says that there are three reasons why we actually record debate in the Mishnah or in the Talmud. The first is to not cast doubt on anybody who may have a tradition contrary. So if for, 30, 40 years, the only thing that was passed down either in written form or especially in oral form before the Mishnah was written down was the consensus opinion, then somebody who comes with a tradition that's contrary to that, that they believe that the Torah, they were taught that the Torah is supposed to be interpreted differently, will look at them like they're crazy, like they're coming out of left field, like they have no authority or no credibility as a rabbi because they're interpreting the Torah contrary to how we do. So the Rambam says, no, show that there's debate. Show that there was a history of debate. And so somebody who really believes otherwise, don't call them a heretic. Don't say that they're not a good rabbi. Don't say that they have a faulty tradition. Rather, just say that, listen, the majority of people have decided against you. There's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with your arguments. It's just that we believe ours are better. That's one reason. The second reason is what we spoke about earlier, which is the concept of judicial review. The Rambam in his commentary to Maseches Edios, I don't have time to read it inside, but you can see it over here, that the Rambam says explicitly that if there is a debate about interpreting a verse, and a future generation actually likes the minority opinion in the Mishnah, they can decide to follow that. If they believe that is more logical in interpreting the text of the Torah, they are obligated to follow that. Doesn't happen often, but theoretically the Rambam says it could, and that's why minority opinions were preserved. The third and final reason, which really goes to the core of the Rambam's identity of having an intellect and ethical development that are proportional, that as great as you are as an intellectual being, you should be equally as great, if not more, in morals. It is to highlight the intellectual honesty. There are times in the Mishnah where it says one person said one way, the other person said the other way, but then they realized that the other party was correct, and so they changed their opinion. So the Rambam says, why would we record that? If the opposition basically said we're wrong, the Rambam says it's to teach us midos, to show us that intellectual honesty is paramount when interpreting the Torah. When there's a body of knowledge that is so critical to trying to understand the wisdom of God, using a finite human mind, intellectual honesty is paramount. So that's it for tonight. Next week, we'll read parts of it inside in the Rambam of things that we didn't talk about now. The Rambam actually presents it in somewhat of a narrative form in terms of tracing the development and the history of the evolution to the Mishnah. So we'll read that next week. And then we'll actually, if there's time, we'll start the next part of the Rambam's introduction, which is up until now, we've been talking about the halachic component of Torah Sheba'al Peh. But it's important to not forget that there's a whole agadic or a homiletical component to the oral law, which the Rambam says is also very important. And the Rambam will talk about how that came about as well. All right. So I'm going to stop sharing. If anybody has any questions or comments, you can feel free to unmute yourself or share in the chat as well. All right. Well, it was wonderful, wonderful learning with you all, and looking forward to continuing next week. All right, everyone. Have a great evening and a great week.